From the studios of KPCW in Park City, it's This Green Earth, a weekly talk show about the environment and our connections with it. I'm Nell Larson.
And I'm Chris Cherniak.
In the first half of the show today, we'll be speaking with Douglas Chadwick, wildlife biologist, author, and journalist. Doug has studied mountain goats, harlequin ducks, and grizzly bears, and reported from the field on everything from snow leopards to right whales. Much of this work has been done for National Geographic. Today, though, we're talking with Doug about wolverines. He's written a book called The Wolverine Way, participates in the Glacier Wolverine Project, and today we'll ask about their incredible adaptations, their role in Utah, and their place in a warming climate.
Then, in the second half of the show, we'll speak with Jeff Masters of Weather Underground. 2014 was determined by NASA and NOAA to be the warmest year on record, surpassing previous record years of 2005 and 2010.
Jeff will explain why this occurred, what makes this record year different from the others, and if we can expect more of the same in 2015. With oil at $47 a barrel, the answer is probably yes.
Yes, I agree with that one. All of that and some news from the Summit County Power Works on how Summit Community Power Works, on how you can save 10 to 30% on your monthly power bill by turning off your rooftop heat tape when it's not needed. Like most of this winter.
Most of the winter.
And at least probably most of this week.
Absolutely. And you can join in on today's conversation with both of our guests by posting your questions to our Facebook page, KPCW This Green Earth.
Our connections with and impacts upon the environment. That's what This Green Earth is all about. Stay with us.
Hi, I'm Mitch Martino.
And I'm Marta Mishral. We're from Park City High School.
Stay in touch with all things miners with our weekly Miner Nation Report.
We'll bring it to you every Monday morning during the morning news with Leslie Thatcher.
And in the afternoon with The Local View with Randy Barton.
Highlights, scores, schedules.
All things Park City Miners Athletics.
The Miner Nation Report is brought to you by
UPS Stores,
Rich Fine, Realtor,
and Elliott Work Group.
Go Miners!
Welcome back to This Green Earth. I'm Nell Larson, and that's Chris Cherniak across the board.
Go Miners.
Such enthusiasm. And on the first half of the show with us today is Douglas Chadwick. He's a wildlife biologist, author, and wolverine expert. And so we'll be talking all about the mysterious wolverine on today's show. Doug, thanks for joining us.
Well, good morning. Northwestern Montana, where it looks like Superman's Fortress of Solitude out here. We've got ice and snow everywhere.
Really?
We're envious of that.
Yeah.
So tell us a little bit about, you know, how long have you been studying wolverines and how did you get started on this track? It seems like a unique niche.
Well, okay, first of all, thank you for describing me as a wolverine expert, and I'm going to walk that back a little bit. I am a wildlife biologist, and I've studied mountain goats and grizzly bears and other critters in the Rockies. But with wolverines, I don't know that anybody knows about them, enough about them yet to go around and you know, put your thumb under your armpit and say, I'm an expert. If that's the point, is we knew almost nothing about them. Until just recently. And, you know, we knew they were declining. We knew they had actually been eliminated from the lower 48 states by 1920. There weren't any around. Hmm. They were shot, trapped, and poisoned. Predator poisons were pretty widespread. And so we were completely out of wolverines. And they have started coming back. Well, they started in the 60s and 70s, but then they hit a point where they seem to be, if anything, declining. We probably have 250 to 300 in the whole lower 48 states.
Wow.
That's not many wolverines. You can put them all in your front room. It kind of gets snarly, but
right.
Stick them all in here.
So give us...
Go ahead.
I was going to say, you know, give us an idea, kind of characterize the wolverine for us and just tell us about the animal itself. Give us a picture.
Okay. I want to clear up one other thing. Now, I did not do original research on wolverines. What I did was volunteer on a cool wolverine project in the backcountry of Glacier Park, which actually learned more about wolverines than we'd known in centuries. And it was fun to go out every day and discover something new about an animal that was mostly known from legends and myths and trappers' tales and so on. So what we found, well, let's start with what we thought we knew. They were supposed to be like Tasmanian devils on crack, right?
Mm-hmm.
They were surly, solitary, too vicious to get along with each other. They only got together to mate. And other than that, just went around the, you know, the woods and mountains sort of preying on animals much larger than themselves, and were highly elusive and extremely wary, and on and on and on. So what we found was a 30-pound animal that can indeed back off a grizzly bear from a carcass. And that is some extreme behavior right
there.
Wow, that's impressive.
And they do have a ton of attitude, and it's all about being able to they're a scavenger. And it's all about being able to compete with the likes of mountain lions and wolves and bears over carcasses. And so they have a extra large growl. It sounds like a we would catch them in these log box traps to get radio collars on them. And when you walked up on it, it sounded like you had a velociraptor in there.
Right.
Or a Harley Davidson mating with a chainsaw or, you know, something really bad. And that growl is designed to intimidate.
Yeah.
And their whole attitude is, you know, I'm crazy. I want this food out here. And you're going to have to fight me, and I'm ready to die for it. I don't know. I'm getting a little carried away. But, I mean, they really, attitude gets you a long ways if you're a scavenger out in a world full of other big predators. And it works for them. That's a essential part of how they make their living.
Right.
But having said all that, what we found was that they do have a family structure. They don't kick out their young permanently at 6 months of age like they thought. They're able to stay in their mom and dad's territory for another year and a half, and therefore they're defended from other predators and other territorial wolverines coming in by their parents. They travel from time to time with their mother after they're 6 months of age, and they sometimes go off and travel with dad. So it's much more interesting. They're a much more complex animal. They're pretty smart. They're like we often discover about predators. We tell surly, vicious stories about them. I don't know why. I guess it suits something about our view of them. But they seldom turn out to be true, and it certainly didn't turn out to be true for wolverines. So,
Doug, why were these animals hunted to near extinction? What was the... Were
well,
they a nuisance?
Fur,
were they fur?
Oh, well, first of all, I think their fur is, it sheds frost well.
Mm-hmm.
It is very warm and insulating, and it's a big part of how they're able to live in a niche that's mostly near the top of the mountains. It's the alpine and subalpine zone.
Mm.
And so people used it for roughs on parkas. It's lovely stuff, and it was much in demand. But in addition to that, they just suffered from being a meat eater because there was a point in the 20th century when people were going around just broadcasting poison baits to get rid of predators in general.
Mm.
And being a scavenger, a wolverine's job is to go out, and if there's food somewhere out in the landscape, find it. And so that really took them out once they'd been reduced already by kind of wanton or unregulated trapping and hunting.
Right, right.
So it sounds like these animals have incredible adaptations and physical a physical form that allows them to survive and thrive in these incredibly cold, harsh environments.
Exactly. That's what they do better than anybody. They have big snowshoe-like feet, and they've got pretty long claws, so they've got crampons on the end of 20 toes. And these guys can they can scale straight up these cliffs and avalanche chutes and just incredible stuff. They're kind of super-powered critters, and they have an extra big heart and an extra big lungs, and a stomach that they can exist on just by crunching up bones, not just to get at the marrow, but there are fats and oils in some of the larger bones, and somehow they can make a living on top of the world where they can outcompete, move through the country faster and better than any other critter there.
Wow.
And so they have these enormous territories in mountain ranges where if you and I were there and we got 5 miles in a day up and down these things, we go home and brag about it. And the wolverine is covering, 100-some miles a week through the most jumbled-up terrain in the Rockies. And really extraordinary.
For a wolverine, that's called a Tuesday. That's right. So
that's called. Was that a tall mountain? I didn't notice.
And you mentioned, do they have any predators? Is there any animal crazy enough in the forest to attack a wolverine?
Well, like I started off kind of blathering about backing off grizzly bears, and it works if it's a. I assume if it's a juvenile bear, a young one that's unsure of itself, or maybe a bear that's had plenty to eat, it certainly doesn't always work. We found some carcasses with puncture holes in the skull that were about bear canine size. So that wolves and cougars do occasionally take a wolverine. Other wolverines kill them in territorial battles.
Mm.
Okay. So... yeah, they're not immune. But once they reach adulthood, the radioed animals that we followed, they tend to last pretty well. They can live up to 12 years, maybe a bit longer. But the average number of kits born is about 2, and usually one survives to the first year of age because it is a tough world out there. And then survival's not too great until they get a bit older and establish a territory, and after that they seem to do pretty well. But that doesn't mean they're not out there tussling with some big bite ewes,
right?
To get a meal.
Okay.
So, and I keep saying we did this and we did that, and I'm not really an expert. I volunteered on this project. I tagged along with some really good scientists, and I'm now. Doing the same thing in the North Cascades, where there's a bit of a comeback of wolverines. We're talking about maybe a couple dozen, a few dozen anyway, and in the Tetons, and in southern British Columbia and Alberta. So I'm an enthusiastic volunteer and a journalist and reporter.
Okay.
So let's talk a little bit about the range in the U.S. You said that, obviously they'd been all extirpated and then they kind of had a comeback. Even here in Utah, there was a wolverine, confirmed on camera in 2014, and people were getting really excited about that. And the Utah Division of Wildlife Resources says they receive 5 to 10, quote, credible wolverine sightings per year. Mm-hmm. So what does that mean for wolverines in Utah? What would their place look like here?
Okay, I'm glad I got the part about not being an expert out there because I'm not going to claim I would know the answer to that. But here's what I think is interesting: there's been a wolverine that showed up in the Tahoe area in Northern California, and it came 600 miles from Central Idaho Mountains.
What?
Another one showed up in Rocky Mountain National Park in Colorado, and it came 500 miles down not only through mountains but across sagebrush prairies from the Tetons.
Really?
Now, these are young males dispersing, and this is what young male carnivores do. They look around. The territories, on all sides are full, And so they've got to go out and find a place where they don't have to fight to establish a territory, and sometimes they just keep going. I followed a cougar one time indirectly from the Black Hills of South Dakota to Connecticut. It was about 30 miles from New York City.
Wow.
So,
yeah, really?
Yeah, really. This stuff goes on frequently. So what I'm getting at is, as I talk to people and give talks about wolverines, because I really very much do want to get them up on the radar and get them more attention so that people take a little more care in managing them, and they've got a future in the lower 48. So as I talk to people, whether it's Oregon or Utah, Colorado, they say, oh, gosh, that wasn't the first wolverine back since 1916. That I saw a wolverine in 1970. Right. I reported it to the authorities, but they dismissed it as a mistaken observation. And I think these animals have probably been dispersing off and on, the odd one taking a long trek, all probably right along each decade. But what's the difference these days is that there is more attention on wolverines, and more importantly, there are these camera traps all over the countryside. Good quality automatic cameras.
Right.
And so there are wolverines showing up in Oregon, the ones I mentioned in California, the Uintas. I don't know that this represents a big move south, but there is a bit more movement that we're recording. And as I said, there's been a recovery in the North Cascades of Washington State where there were no wolverines at all for decades. So, don't know what that means.
Wow.
They're still very subject to getting caught in traps set for bobcats or coyotes or wolves or whatever. And so, yes, there's a lot of movements, but there are also a lot of wolverines end up as what they call non-target or incidental captures and killed that way. So,
yeah.
They've got a lot of obstacles to... There's a big difference between a lone male showing up and a wolverine that brings a date to one of these distant locations and can establish a viable population.
If you just join us, we're speaking with Douglas Chadwick. He is a researcher of wolverines and the author of the book, The Wolverine Way. Hey, Doug, we want to... we got another 5 minutes or so. In fact, the second half of the show, we're going to be talking about climate change and the fact that 2014 was the warmest year on record. What if any trends might you be teasing out of the data with respect to warming environments and impacts on wolverine habitat and wolverine behavior?
Right, good question, Chris. The wolverine has been proposed for listing as threatened or endangered. As I said, there are probably 300 tops in the lower 48. Of those, they figure there are, let's just say 36 breeding females that are going to pass their genes on to the next generation. That's not a very viable number. And so each time there's been sort of different reasons to list them, more disturbance, more habitat loss from development in some areas, so on and so forth. But basically, they're up, as I said, in the alpine and subalpine zones. They don't come down into the lowlands. They don't prey on livestock. They don't eat tourists, so they don't get, don't get in a lot of trouble. There's not a lot of resistance to listing them, but a lot of people oppose it just on principle. You know, they're a carnivore. They're a predator. But last time, the biggest reason put forward were studies showing that they depend very much on year-round cool temperatures. They are not found much where the average summer temperature gets above 70 degrees in August. And they rely on deep lingering snows for their den sites, which will be dug 10 to 12 feet down in the snow where they have their young. They don't hibernate, but the young are protected there for several months. And they also cache their food. These are great scavengers. They tear off a lot of food from a bigger carcass, and they go bury it in different places, and most often in snowbanks and or under boulders where they've got cold water running underneath. So they're the nature's refrigerators.
Right.
What happens to all those things in a warming climate scenario? So that was the big concern. As they're, as the glaciers disappear and the snowpack retreats higher, spring comes earlier and fall lasts later, it looks as though their range will contract, and that means the populations, which are already somewhat isolated in different mountain ranges, will become more fragmented or more isolated from one another, and it's going to be a real challenge for them to deal with that. So that's the consensus of the scientific community. That's not my particular findings, but I can tell you that from starting to feel old, because when I go back into Glacier Park, I'm looking at, which had 150 glaciers in 1910 when it was established, and it now has 23.
Wow.
And I say I feel old because I look at up on the mountainsides where I used to see a continuous big glacier scouring down the slopes, and now I see little melting snowfields, or I see nothing at all. And that's the wolverine's world, and it's the mountain goat's world, and the ptarmigan, and the hoary marmots, and a whole suite of creatures that the wolverine sort of symbolizes, in a sense. So that's very much worth paying attention to. And the other thing that, the other important message from wolverines in the time we've got left is they have these enormous territories. They are exclusive territories. Each wolverine maintains one of several hundred square miles.
What?
And you can't fit very many into any one area because of that territoriality.
Right.
So you have to have large connected landscapes for these guys to survive over time. Otherwise, you get the island effect of a few isolated here and a few there. And about 85% of all extinctions that we know of since 1500 have been on oceanic islands. And that tells you what's going to happen as wildlife becomes more fragmented and isolated on land, and ecosystems become, or wildlands become effectively islands. So that's the news from the wolverine front.
So I have to ask one more question before we let you go. We've talked about these massive ranges and how, you know, the populations are not concentrated and they live in these formidable environments. What does the field work look like to study these guys? How do you track them, and what does it entail?
Well, first of all, I hope I've conveyed the fact that it helps to be nuts to go out and study wolverines.
Sure.
Both, okay, good.
You don't mind skiing through blizzards and cross avalanche slopes and dragging a sled full of bait, you know, somewhere up onto a mountainside. We can't keep up with wolverines. Hence the new information about them is largely from satellite collars. And without that, we probably never would have learned just how far and how often they move, and how much they master those steep slopes and treat the mountains as though they were flat. But it's a real chore, because you're trying to track a wolverine that is going at least 20 miles a day, and in the course of a week, huge distances, but it's mostly the terrain. You're at risk a lot of the time you're out there, at least in the Rocky Mountains, and because of the snow slides and just because of conditions. But the wolverine's perfectly adapted to these things. That's why it's there. This is an ice age creature. That's when it evolved. And it's got an amped up metabolism, and that double fur coat insulating it, and these big snowshoe feet. So it's doing fine. And you're staggering along behind trying to keep up and learn a little bit of information at one time. But now, if I can add one thing before we sign off, do you have another second?
Yeah.
Quickly.
You talked about climate change. The other animal I've been working on lately is a grizzly bear that lives in the Gobi Desert of Mongolia. And I can't see your faces, but I don't know. When I first heard about them, I just kind of looked dumbfounded because it just didn't make sense. But it's a brown bear, which is Ursus arctos, grizzly, same one we've got here in Montana next door to my place. But it's a different subspecies, and it lives in one of the world's most extreme environments outside of where wolverines live. But it's a desert. And what do you suppose is happening to the fauna in a place like that under a warming, drying climate scenario?
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I see it on both ends. And I think it's something we we all need to work at finding ways to adapt to.
Douglas Chadwick is the author of The Wolverine Way. Doug, website people can go to learn more about you or the book or Wolverines in general?
Well, they should all buy the book for everyone in their family, but the website, best place to go is a website from the Wolverine Foundation, and it's just wolverinefoundation.org.
Okay.
And that has good, what would I say, popular data, I mean a short synopsis of the animals, but it also has scientific references. It has all about wolverines at every level, and that's the best single source I can recommend to you.
Okay.
Fantastic. Well, Doug, thank you so much for joining us today to talk all about wolverines. And
well, thanks for the opportunity.
Yeah.
Whoever thought somebody'd want to hear about wolverines. I never, they've been off the radar for decades, and now you're helping keep them up there. So thank you.
We do what we can. One at a time. All right. Thanks again, Doug. We'll be in touch.
Okay.
Thank you.
Well, thank you again.
All right.
Bye-bye.
Hey, let's take a break for some underwriters and sponsors. And when we come back, Jeff Masters, Director of Meteorology from the Weather Underground, joins us to talk about 2014, the warmest year on record. It's This Green Earth. Stay tuned.
Hi, this is Reese DeMille with Republic Services, your local source for recycling and garbage service and a proud sponsor of KPCW's This Green Earth. As you recycle, please remember, glass cannot go in your residential curbside recycling bin. Help keep Summit County Recycling clean. SummitCountyRecycles.org.
This is Dana Edwards on behalf of Vail Resorts and Cannons Resort supporting KPCW. This year, we developed partnerships with 25 local nonprofits to support programs like the fourth grade program at Swanner Preserve and Eco Center. Every fourth grader in Summit County will experience Utah's ecosystem firsthand and see science come to life through infield classes. Thanks to Swanner for making science cool.
Welcome back to This Green Earth, a weekly talk show on environmental issues and concepts of sustainability. I'm Chris Cherniak, Nell Larson across the board. We're going to be speaking with Jeff Masters, Director of Meteorology at Weather Underground, in a couple minutes, as soon as we get him on the line. Live radio is like that. Really interesting conversation with Doug Chadwick all about wolverines and his book The Wolverine Way. I didn't get a chance to find out what's the difference between a wolverine and a badger. I think they're similar, but we'll have to follow up with Doug on that.
So,
do you know the difference between a wolverine and a badger? No.
Wolverines are tougher. And
you think so, than a badger?
Yeah. No, I have to share a fact that I read when I was reading up on wolverines. And this is that they, have been doing this radio tracking, right? And they watched one wolverine climb Mount Cleveland, which is the tallest peak in Glacier National Park. And I mean, this thing is like practically vertical. And the wolverine gained 4,900 vertical feet in 90 minutes. Like 5,000 feet in an hour and a half, and for no apparent reason, decided to run to the very, very tip top, the summit of the peak, and
then come back down.
Yeah.
Workout.
Yeah, just a
they
nice
are,
little.
They are the crazy neighbor of the forest.
That's all.
I'm just going to conclude at that. The crazy neighbor of the forest.
Yeah.
So
perfect.
Wolverines. We'll have to keep in touch with Douglas on his wolverine research,
and other crazy species.
Yes, hey, this is a awkward segue, but joining us is Jeff Masters, Director of Meteorology for the Weather Underground. We were just talking about wolverines, Jeff.
I wouldn't know anything about those, having only spent 10 and a half years at the University of Michigan.
Oh, yes. There you go. That's the team.
Perfect.
Compared to Badgers at the University of Wisconsin. See, we didn't know where the difference was between a wolverine and a badger, besides some of the obvious things with respect to football prowess, et cetera. But we'll leave
both
it at
furry
that.
Furry creatures that can be terribly annoying.
Yeah. Exactly. So, anyways, let's talk weather and climate with you, Jeff. We appreciate you taking the time to join us this morning to talk about, well, 2014. It's gone down in the books as the warmest year, quote-unquote, on record. And so, first of all, explain to us what we mean by on record. What does that mean?
We've got measurements going back to 1880 from surface stations all across the globe, thousands of stations on every continent, and ocean measurements as well, taken from ships back in the 1800s and more recently from buoys and satellites in the last few decades. So if you do some complicated averaging over the entire surface of the Earth and come up with a global surface temperature, 2014 comes out as the hottest year on record.
Right, and hottest compared to what other years? Who was the previous record holder?
Previous record holder was 2010 and 2005, which were roughly tied, and then 1998 comes out in fourth place.
And how big are those differences? How much warmer is 2014?
We're only talking a few hundredths of a degree. So, you know, just kind of a little bit of an increment over the past record. But those little blips add up. If you keep on having warmest year on records every four or so years, I mean, those numbers add up, and we've seen an increase in Earth's temperature of about a degree and a half Fahrenheit since the 1800s.
Okay, so but somebody I was talking to said, "Oh, a few hundredths of a degree, if that's whether it's Celsius or Fahrenheit, does that really matter? Does that make a difference, or is that just within the margin of error of this data?"
It is within the margin of error, and 1 year alone does not matter. So you really need to talk about 30 years to talk about climate, and if you average over 30 years, then yeah, you got a pretty respectable trend. I mean, the temperature's gone up almost a half a degree Fahrenheit over the past 30 years, and that's significant.
Right. And that's the challenge, though, for climate scientists like you to try to convey that message, that a half a degree means something. It means something with respect to weather patterns. It can mean something, of course, for everything down to the wolverine's habitat that we were talking about. That's changing, too, and that has an impact on plants and animals and sea life, et cetera. But most people will just kind of shrug it off, saying, oh, it's a half a degree. But it does mean something.
Yeah, a half a degree may not seem like much, like you said, but there are finely balanced ecosystems where a half a degree is a huge difference. For instance, if your average temperature happens to be, say, 32 Fahrenheit, and now it's 32.5 Fahrenheit, that's a huge difference. Because if you're near the point of freezing, now you're going to have melting occurring, where before maybe you didn't have average melting. So that's a huge impact in the Arctic, for instance.
Right. Well, I always like to use the analogy of our body temperatures, too, 98.6. If our body temperature goes up 1 degree, we may feel a bit out of sorts. If it goes up a degree and a half, and if you're a male, you're in bed, you know, sick. Whereas if you're my mom, it would take 3 or 4 degrees, like most women. But the point is that small changes in systems, biological systems like our body, even a degree or a degree and a half, has huge consequences. So,
yeah, I mean, you can look at the onset of fall and spring, for instance, over North America. Over the past 30 years, spring has come earlier by an average of 10 days, and fall has come later by an average of 10 days. Mm. So you've increased the growing season by several weeks. That's a huge impact, potentially.
Yeah. Okay. Good.
So one thing that I wanted, and you guys touched on this, but that I wanted to kind of get out of the way is, can you talk through what this, you know, margin of error or degree of uncertainty means? Because I think, you know, this news first came out, it had been the hottest year, everybody covered it, and then shortly thereafter, you know, a lot of the news outlets were saying, sorry, Jeff, do we still have you there?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. A lot of the news outlets were saying, oh, actually, they're not sure. And scientists are saying it's only 30% chance. So explain what that means and how scientists came to the conclusion that, yes, it was the warmest year, even though there's some degree of uncertainty within that.
Yeah, if you're looking at the entire planet and then millions of measurements, there's going to be some uncertainty. A lot of those measurement sites have changed over the years. The instruments have errors. And we're trying to interpolate over areas that don't have measurements. For instance, over Africa and the Arctic, you don't have stations.
Mm-hmm.
So there's going to be some degree of error. So you give an average value, your best estimate of what the number is, and then you give an error bar. You say, well, it could be, you know, maybe a tenth of a degree this way or a tenth of a degree that way. So when you include those error bars, now you're looking at a number that is not precise. I mean, there's an uncertainty involved. And yeah, NOAA and NASA said that there's somewhere between a 38 and 48% chance that 2014 was the warmest year on record. And they didn't tell you that, you know, the odds go down significantly for all the other years.
Right.
For instance, they think 2010 is like 20% chance it was the warmest year on record, and 2005 maybe like a 9% chance. So if you add up all those percent chances, you come up with somewhere around 100%.
Right.
So there's like an 80 or 90% chance that one of those years in the past 10 years was the warmest year on record, with 2014 most likely being the one.
Okay. Well,
interesting.
So this is the average temperature. Where did we see some extremes? Where, give us some examples of some really warm areas of the globe this past
year.
Yeah,
I mean, the oceans, they experienced their warmest year on record. And for 7 months of 2014, the oceans topped out as, you know, the record-setting hottest year for oceans. So that was the biggie that we saw.
Yeah.
And that's probably going to have a big impact on coral reefs because they're very sensitive to ocean temperatures. I think we'll see some die-offs in some of the coral reefs, the bleaching episodes that happen
right
when the ocean temperatures get warm. Over land, we certainly didn't see it over the U.S. In fact, the central U.S. had the coolest anomaly relative to average of any place on the globe last year, just about any place else. Every other continent had record warmth. Well, Alaska had some record warmth, Russia, Europe, certainly, Western Europe was tremendously warm, and Australia, you know, every single continent except large regions of North America were record warm
last year. Well, the Western U.S., the far west, had record
temperatures. Yeah, California
temperature.
Had its warmest year on record.
Alaska, I think, had some really warm temperatures.
Yeah, Alaska, California, Arizona, and I believe Nevada all had their warmest year on record last year.
Okay. So, and is it the northern hemisphere, as you look at the globe and the image that we saw, the figure that was produced, it looks like the northern hemisphere, particularly the Arctic, is really experiencing higher than average temperatures than, say, the southern hemisphere?
Yeah, the northern hemisphere did have warmer temperatures last year than the southern. And in particular, the Arctic is the fastest warming part of the globe. It's warming somewhere between 2 and 3 times faster than the rest of the globe. And that's because, but this effect we talked about before, you know, if your temperature is 32.5 versus 32 degrees, that causes a big impact. Now when you're melting ice, you get a situation where you uncover dark water, which absorbs more sunshine
right
because it's darker, and it increases temperatures even more. It's called a feedback loop, and or a vicious cycle is a better way to put it. And the Arctic is warming very fast because of these vicious cycles going on.
Right. And what does that mean with respect to weather patterns? We saw here, let's for example, Jeff, in November, we had a really cold snap around mid-month in our first big storm. And then we had the warmest 10 to 12 days of December. First 10 to 12 days of December were a record setting. And then we had really, really cold weather the end of December, record cold
yeah
weather. Now we're back to where temperatures are 4 to 5 degrees above average, and say, looking at the weather for the next 5 days or so, it's going to be quite above average in the 40s, even approaching 50 here in Park City
yeah
near the end of this week. So we're seeing big, big variations. Is that something that is going to become more common?
I wish I knew the answer to that, and I call it weather whiplash. We've certainly been seeing really crazy weather extremes over the past about 4 years. And I wrote an article in Scientific American back in the December issue which talked about this. And this weather whiplash is due to the jet stream, which is the river of upper-level winds that tends to control our weather. And when that river of upper-level winds starts taking on unusual contortions, we get extreme weather patterns like we've seen. Mm. Depending on which side of the jet you're on, if you're on the cold side to the north or the warm side to the south, you'll experience widely different weather patterns. And when that jet starts taking really big loops and excursions, and normally it flows straight east to west, if now it's going in these big U-shaped troughs and ridges that we've been seeing of late, then you can get really extreme weather patterns. And there's a couple of theories saying why we're starting to see a more extreme jet stream. One of them is due to the warming of the Arctic. And if that's so, then maybe we'll see an increase in these sorts of extremes. But we're not really sure what's causing the jet stream to be more extreme. We've just noticed that it has been happening, particularly over North America, the past few years.
Okay. If you just join us, we're speaking with Jeff Masters. He's the director of meteorology at the Weather Underground, otherwise known as weatherunderground.org. Oh, geez, Jeff, I'm sorry. Is that .org or .com?
We're .com.
.com, okay. And we're talking about, among other things, the fact that 2014 was the warmest year on record. And this is a pretty, there's a lot of consensus. NOAA, NASA, but the UK meteorological authorities agree to this. And there's, I believe there's another association out of Japan that is going to prepare a report or release a report with the same findings. So the consensus is pretty solid.
Yeah. The UK has not come out with their report yet. That's expected in a few weeks. But yeah, the Japan Meteorological Agency said it was the warmest year on record. So 3 out of 4 of the main groups that do these reports say it was the warmest year on record.
Okay. And I think what's interesting about this year, too, is that this one occurred without the presence of an El Nino, which is kind of serves as a warming force factor or so?
Yes, this record was not a cheap record. All the previous times we've had warmest years on record, they've been boosted by this warm weather or warm water that we see in the eastern Pacific, which surfaces every 2 to 7 years when we get what's called an El Nino event. Warm water from the western Pacific sloshes over to the east and rises to the surface, and that tends to make the global temperature a tenth of a degree warmer, which is enough to give us a record year if you've got some other natural cycles that happen to be giving us a warm year. So we didn't have that last year, and that just says to me that the underlying trend, which is global warming due to burning fossil fuels and other human activities, that's starting to really take charge here. We're getting a warm planet, record warm, even without natural cycles superimposed on it.
Right. Well, we have a question from a listener who wants to know that if these warming trends are occurring and carbon dioxide and other greenhouse gases are playing a major role in this, these trends, we're up around 400 parts per million now on average with respect to carbon dioxide. Is there a way to get a sense of what our warming, what our planet would look like if we were back at 350 or holding at 350 or 360? Is that just something you can just kind of model in a way?
You can look at paleohistory, which means you go back millions of years and you see, okay, what was the planet like when we had 350 parts per million of CO2 in the air?
Yeah.
And all things considered, that's a good target to shoot for.
Right.
It seems like we've got a pretty good climate then. You don't have a lot of sea level rise due to a lot of warmth, and you still have a fair bit of ice on the planet, but not so much ice that you have an ice age. So it's a very delicate balance. Too cold and you get those ice sheets growing. Too warm and you get all the ice sheets melting and sea level rise. And 350 is a great, great target. In fact, there's a whole organization run by Bill McKibben called 350.org,
right,
which is based on the fact that that is a good target.
Okay. So let's got a few minutes left. 2015, what do the tea leaves say with respect to this coming year?
Yeah, global warming is not going away. We increased our levels of CO2 in the atmosphere by another 0.5% last year, or a 2% rise in emissions.
Right.
And we're expecting a similar rise this year.
Yeah.
And we've still got a lot of warm water out in the oceans. They're still record warm. And the oceans take a while to cool off. They got a lot of momentum. So even if we do get some natural cycles that tend to drive a cooler ocean later this year, they're going to remember this warmth that they've had at the beginning of the year, and it's going to be close to another record year this year. In fact, a couple groups are saying more than 50% chance that we will break the record again in 2015, so we'll have two consecutive warmest years on record.
Wow. And is that with or without an El Nino?
It could be a weak El Nino year. That's kind of what our expectation is. So weak El Nino to no El Nino.
Right. So eventually it just doesn't matter. And I agree that those ocean temperatures are really the most unnerving aspect of it. As the ocean's warm, their trend, like you say, they have a lot of momentum behind them, and they absorb a lot of heat. And some people have suggested that this plateau, if you want to call it, that we've been experiencing these last 5 or 6 or 7 years is a function of the oceans just absorbing a lot of heat. But they can only absorb so much at some point.
Yeah, what's going on is, if you look at the amount of energy going in the atmosphere at the top of the atmosphere from a satellite, there's an imbalance. There's more energy going in than it's coming back out, which means the planet has to heat. And yeah, right now, most of that energy has been going into the ocean, but you can't maintain that forever. And that heat is going to come back out of the ocean and warm the atmosphere. And we saw some of that happening in 2014. And every time you get an El Nino event, then you get a little bit more of that influence. So we're going to see some more record warm years in the future.
Well, we've had, like we said, a kind of a wacky winter here. But overall, I think our winters here has been above average. And our last 5, 6, 8, 10 years have been above average here out in Utah. And some of the local climatologists say that the trends here are more significant out west. We're already seeing our 2 to 3 degrees above average with some of the west of the Rockies, and that's going to continue. The precipitation is another issue. Not quite sure how the precipitation plays out. That's a little more difficult to quantify. But this is stuff we're seeing out here, Jeff. So, hey, we got to get going. Jeff, thanks again for joining us.
Okay, you're welcome.
Website?
Wonderground.com or weatherunderground.com.
All right.
And I write a blog talking about weather and climate change, which is featured on the website. And today's post is about freezing rain.
Oh, really?
But last Friday's post was about the record year, 2014.
And yeah, right.
I do talk about hurricanes a lot when it's hurricane season, and tornadoes when it's tornado season.
All those good natural disasters.
Yeah.
Yeah, all of that.
Oh, yeah, you track all the billion-dollar disasters, too.
That's right, yeah.
And they're trending up, I'm sure, too. And as we said in our intro, with oil at $47 a barrel, we can expect carbon dioxide levels to also be trending up, too. Downside of that.
Yeah, it's unfortunate. There's less incentive to develop, solar and wind power when you've got cheap fossil fuels. We're not paying the full price of fossil fuels. They're essentially subsidized.
Yeah.
So that's right. The way it's working.
That's another story for another time. Jeff, Masters, thanks again for joining us.
All right, Chris.
We'll be in touch.
All right.
All right. Let's take a break. One quick break for underwriter and sponsor, and we'll come back. We've got a news item or so. And, on Summit Community Powerworks and some suggestions for your rooftop heat tape. Stay tuned. It's This Green Earth.
Hi, I'm Marin Mullen, and I'm a Recycle Utah board member. Did you know that water conservation is what we're really all about? And you thought it was only recycling. We save your H2O. How? By encouraging you to recycle more, by teaching our students how to conserve water, and by making it possible for you to drop off hazardous waste at our collection events. Yep, we're all about saving your water, because we can't live without it. Recycle Utah is a nonprofit organization bringing conservation ideas to you since 1990. Check us out at recycleutah.org.
Welcome back to This Green Earth. We've got a few minutes left and a few updates for you, I think, on news stories that we covered last week. And so one of the things we did last week was talk with Summit Community Power Works, the group that's working towards the Georgetown Energy Prize.
That's right. $5 million to the winner.
That's right.
The community that reduces their electricity and natural gas consumption the most over a two-year period, beginning January 1st. So
that's we're right. We're in it.
So throw your breakers.
Turn off your lights.
Do what you can.
or turn off the heat.
Don't make us do it. But one thing you can do, and this really, for those of us who have it, this consumes a lot of electricity, as I learned.
So this falls more into the reasonable category instead of turning off your electricity.
This is, we're going to go reasonable first, and then around the final quarter of 2016, we'll get unreasonable. But this is a reasonable change request in changing your behavior. This doesn't cost any money, okay?
We like that.
We have lots of technologies out there that you can go buy more efficient refrigerator or washer dryer or put in LED lights. But this one doesn't cost a thing. All it does is ask you to pay attention to your roof. And if there's no snow on your roof, then turn off your heat tape, because a lot of people around here seem to have a set it and forget it mentality when it comes to heat tape. They turn it on in the middle of November and they come back the middle of March and turn it off. Well, I did that when it was first installed at my place. And my electric bills went up on average about $60 a month. Each month, ooh, the heat tape was on, right. And I was only paying about $100, $110. So there was like a 30 to 40% increase, even more, on my electric bill. So the following year, I started to pay attention then. When I didn't see any snow on the roof, I went out. And then, yes, I walked all the way over to the where the switch was, and I turned it off, you know. And then when I saw snow coming, or even if the snow started to fall and started to accumulate on the roof, I go back and I turn it on. And the amazing thing is that heat tape heats up quick enough that just within 4 or 5 hours, it's melted away the area that it's supposed to control, et cetera. And so by managing that and keeping it off when I didn't need it, I saved, again, $40 to $50 a month, every month from December, January, and February, and then half of November, March. So it was like $150, $160 over the course of the winter. That's a lot.
That is a lot.
I think that's a lot for a lot of people. So go out and check your roofs, and if there's no snow on it, or if the heat tape has done its job, and ironically, heat tape does its best job during the day. At night, when temperatures fall below 28, 27 degrees, the heat tape can't keep up. So it's really just kind of
wasted effort.
There's a lot of energy that's wasted in mismanagement of heat tape. So I'll just say this. You want to treat your oven. You want to keep your oven on warm all the time, with the thought like, I'm going to use it eventually.
When you don't use it,
turn the oven off. When you don't need your heat tape, turn it off. More about that as we go forward, other tips, et cetera. All right, we got one more minute.
We got to wrap up and give people a heads up for our show on Thursday.
Yes.
We will be at Whole Foods from 9 to 11 a.m. doing a live show called The Sundance Reel, interviewing directors and actors in some of this year's Sundance films. And we've got some environmental films, of course, environmental documentaries.
Racing to Extinction.
Yeah. How to Change the World.
How to Change the World. Mm-hmm. Maru is another one. Maybe a couple. And then a few other films, too. So that's at Whole Foods this Friday at 9 a.m.
That's right. Come stop by. Say hi. Grab some breakfast.
All right. Well, now we really got to wrap up the entire show.
Well, thank you to our sponsors of This Green Earth. We'd like to thank Recycle Utah,
Republic Services,
and Vail Resorts.
And of course, you can join us on Facebook with your posts and ideas and thoughts and questions and comments. It's KPCW, This Green Earth.
You can email us at thisgreenearth@kpcw.org.